This is an extract from the Nature podcast. For the full show, go to nature.com/nature/podcast.
First up on this week's show, I recently had the chance to talk to Randall Munro, the cartoonist behind the hugely popular webcomic XKCD, which features stick figures, a lot of pop culture references, and science jokes. If you've ever been to a scientific conference, I'm willing to bet you'll have seen at least one of his cartoon strips used by a speaker to illustrate a point or to get a laugh at the end of their talk. Randall has also written a series of books, the latest of which is called How To: Absurd Scientific Advice for Common Real-World Problems. I asked him about some of the real-world problems he looked at.
I took a lot of simple problems that you might encounter in everyday life, like, you know, the hassle of packing to move, or how to make friends with people. And I'm one of those people who will always find a much more complicated way to do things that I have convinced myself is going to be worth it in the long run. And so I'll say, okay, I know this looks like it's too elaborate or too complicated, but once it gets going, you'll see what a good idea this was. And inevitably, I'm still trying to get it working when the people who are solving the problem the normal way are already done.
Yeah, and I would say all of your questions, then I've got some in front of me here. How to jump really high, how to play football, which works on both sides of the Atlantic, which is great. I mean, they all have sensible starts, and then things quickly veer off into maths and physics and ridiculousness.
Yeah, I usually start somewhere kind of straightforward, and then I often find, you know, I'll come up with some weird idea, and then, of course, I just want to know, would that actually work? So my friend had ants that were in his house, and he texted me and said, I'm so frustrated trying to get these ants out. You know, we've tried all these different things. Could I just build a moat of lava and then that the ants couldn't cross? How much would that cost? And right away, I was like, I don't know. That's really interesting. And then it's like getting a song stuck in your head. When I hear a question like that, I just like, I need to know the answer. And so I think I sort of stopped on the sidewalk and started researching like lava heat flow and the engineering involved in keeping a moat of lava hot so that I could come up with a price estimate.
Well, Randall, what does your sort of research process look like? Do you start with a blank piece of paper and a question mark at the top?
Sometimes I'll have read, you know, a research paper, or I'll have a book on hand that I think has an answer in it. Sometimes the questions are strange enough that the best place to look isn't necessarily a research paper or a scholarly source. At one point, I remember I wanted to find out whether or not pollen, when it falls from trees, is particularly flammable. I thought it might be because it's, you know, dusty particles, but I wasn't sure. And I was reading through a couple of papers on pollen and fire risk, and I was having trouble finding a straight answer. And then I realized, wait a minute, the world is full of teenagers with matches. And I just went on YouTube and searched pollen flammable and found all these videos of people lighting pollen in their driveway on fire and causing a huge dangerous, you know, whoosh. And that was a much faster way to find the answer to the question, is pollen flammable, than a research paper.
Well, what is the value of talking about, well, the absurd in many cases? I mean, you talk about opening water bottles with a nuclear bomb to fill up a swimming pool, for example. What's the value of using these scenarios to answer questions?
I think that it lets you explore ideas that would otherwise be kind of abstract. So in the example of using nuclear weapons to open water bottles, for one thing, it sounds ridiculous, but it is something that the U.S. government actually tried in the early Cold War era. Now, they were actually trying not to open the bottles. What they did was they set a bunch of bottles out near Ground Zero. They mostly used beer, I think, but also carbonated beverages, and measured how well they survived the blast and whether the liquid inside was still drinkable. Exploring this idea is a way, like I learned this history that I didn't know about, you know, and it also is a way to learn about nuclear weapons and about glass bottles. They found that in general, the bottles weren't broken unless they were knocked off the shelves. And it's also just fun. Like, I find that even when a question is not practical at all, I get excited about knowing the answer. And if I find out there's a way to get it, especially if it involves some interesting research, I just really enjoy it.
I mean, you've got some guest stars as well, you know, as part of your book. Notably, Chris Hadfield, astronaut, and Serena Williams, one of the greatest tennis players of all time. And they got involved too and seemed to be quite good sports about it.
Yeah, I think that the chapter where I talked to Chris Hadfield was probably my single favorite part of the book. I did a chapter on how to make an emergency landing. And Colonel Hadfield is a test pilot, in addition to being former commander of the International Space Station. And so I asked him about unusual landing situations. He just answered every question. No pause, no hesitation. When I asked him the first question about, if you have to land in a cultivated field, which crop is the best to aim for? And he just immediately, you know, says, well, I fly small planes, and that's the kind of stuff we think about all the time. When you're driving to the airport, you keep an eye out. You look around at the fields and think, how high are their beans right now? Have they brought in their hay? Has it rained recently? Because you can't land in a muddy field. And he just went on like this, laying out answers to every stranger and stranger question. And it was all very matter of fact. And he had a flight he was going to. He actually kept talking to me. He said, oh no, hang on, I'm just gonna scan my boarding pass and I'll be right back. And then he continued talking to me as he walked down the jetway onto a plane. And I think at that point, I had to end the interview because I didn't want him describing how he would land a plane if he were trapped on the outside as he walks down the aisle past all the other passengers. I was like, we must be freaking someone out here.
Your book is absolutely rammed with facts. I mean, what's the one that kind of blew your mind the most? That, you know, if our listeners to hear one fact, what was your favorite?
One really surprising fact I learned was in the chapter on how to deliver a package from space. How do you throw it out of the space station and protect it so that it will make it down to the surface without burning up? Almost anything you throw out of the space station will burn up in the atmosphere, but certain very thin and lightweight objects may slow down and descend without ever reaching high temperatures. So if you wrote a message on a piece of paper or a piece of, you know, baking paper, and it were curved right, you could potentially toss it out the window of the space station and it would just flutter all the way to the surface intact. So there was actually a project to launch paper airplanes from the International Space Station by some Japanese researchers, which sadly never went through.
Goodness. I mean, I guess if we ever see a piece of paper fluttering down with help and just an arrow pointing up, then we need to have a close look at it, right?
Yes, the return to sender is a little bit more difficult.